Today it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Mary Sarah Bilder. She's professor of law here at Boston College Law School, where she teaches American legal and constitutional history. Following reception of her JD and PhD from Harvard University in law and in the history of American civilization, respectively, she clerked on the Fourth Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals. She's the author of numerous scholarly articles, as well as the award-winning book, The Transatlantic Constitution, Colonial Legal Culture and the Empire. That was from Harvard in 2004. And she's held visiting professorial appointments at Columbia and Harvard Law Schools. Her presentation today stems from ongoing work on a new book project, and her title for us today is Madison's Hand, Remembering the Constitutional Convention, or Thoughts on the History of the Book and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition. Welcome.
That is a lovely introduction. Thank you very much, and thanks to Alan and Suzanne and to Corrine, who found more work available on the web of mine than I had thought was available on the web. As I say, the talk has sort of two components. One's going to be about the actual work on Madison's Hand, and then there's another conversation that comes out of the seminar on Catholic intellectual traditions. And if you're here for the Madison part, don't worry, we'll get there. But there's a prefatory part that's going to fit in with Alan's seminar. And in that sense, let me start by saying, I suppose it's unusual to be talking about James Madison at a talk that comes out of the university seminar on Catholic intellectual traditions, because Madison was a nominal Protestant, a largely separationist president in terms of church and state, and the way in which one might initially think of linking him to a tradition associated with this university is that in the 19th century, political opponents sometimes accused him of being Jesuitical, which was not a compliment like it is today, for being perceived to change his position on states' rights. I want to talk today about the way in which this project engages with a set of questions that I think cast light on the idea of the phrase and concept Catholic intellectual traditions. Now, so at the outset, let me emphasize that I understand the term Catholic intellectual traditions to have a doubleness. And this really comes from a comment that James Morris made early on, maybe last year in the seminar, that Catholic has two important meanings. One is associated with the church as a Christian church, and this is the way in which we tend to often use it. But Catholic also has an older meaning, that which is comprehensive, universal, all-encompassing. And in this talk, I'm going to start with the two connections between this project and Catholic in the first sense, and then suggest in ways the way in which these connections shift us towards Catholic in the second sense. And let me begin by talking a little bit about James Madison as a note taker, because this is the part sort of the entree that I'm interested in. He was an 18th century man, and as a note taker, he wasn't particularly unusual. What might be unusual is that he kept a significant number of his notes, and in part this may be because he had no children. And one set of notes, so there was nobody to get impatient and throw away everything. One set of notes that's actually remain held by Dolly Madison's descendants are a set of notes he took as a very young man, and they're abstracts from the memoirs of the Cardinal de Retz. Now, Retz is somebody we don't necessarily read any longer. Probably most people in the room, other than Areta, do not know who he was. But he was very well read in the 18th century. A publication of memoirs came out in 1717. He was educated by the Jesuits at Claremont. He had a reputation, his biographer says, for academic brilliance and rebellious behavior. And he went on to become a cardinal and then became aligned with the Fronde, with the rebellion. And he's quite difficult to place. Various writers have considered him of Jansenist sympathies and in essence, opposed to the Jesuits. And he's also been considered, quote, a cynical atheist and also a person of great piety. So there's a lot in there. And the memoirs are written, as one person writes, with tension and ambiguity, in which historical testimony mingled with autobiography, and the attempt to recreate past experience coexists with the desire to analyze the experience and to comment upon it from another point in time. And Madison takes extensive notes out of Retz and copies a number of sayings, many of which are surprisingly useful today. For example, caution is most necessary with regard to the people because nothing is more unruly, but that caution is most carefully to be concealed from them, for nothing is more distrustful. And if you know 18th century politics, you can see why he appeals to them. And there's one of the quotes that I think is very instructive about what Madison found in Rex is this one. There is a critical minute in everything, and the masterpiece of good conduct is to perceive it and take hold of it. If it is missed, chiefly in revolutions of state, 'tis odds if it can be met with or perceived again. Now, I think Rex reminds us that while we often think about Catholic intellectual traditions as a phrase focusing on religion or God or spirituality or even social justice at its center, politics and power were intimately connected with Catholicism and Catholic writers. And so in that sense, I think Rex really speaks to that tradition. I think Rex and his memoirs also show Catholic in the second sense as a narrative about the universal quest to understand power and politics, to understand what Rex says in his introduction is man, and he doesn't mean that in necessarily a good way. And Madison was deeply influenced by Rex at the end of his life. One of the young men who came to visit Madison told of often recalling Rex and the memoirs while he listened to Madison reminisce about his share of an events of the national moment. And I think Madison's own notes were his effort to try and pass on to future generations his perception of this critical minute, that this had been a critical minute and in a sense it hadn't been lost. Now, in focusing on notes and note-taking, I'm approaching Madison from an interdisciplinary field of study that we now often call the history of the book. It had other names earlier on, but this is the one that most people refer to it nowadays. And it's a field that's really come into being over the last two decades. And at the center of that field stands the Jesuit Walter Ong, and his work's been enormously influential, beginning really in the early 80s in a set of pieces where he talked about the way in which writing is a technology that restructures thought. And Ong's work is not Catholic so much in the first sense, although you would instantly understand where he comes to this question as a Jesuit and a Catholic. But Ong's work is very strongly Catholic in the second sense. In his work, he's constantly searching for the universal, how shifts from orality to writtenness structure our understanding. And Robin Alston, who's now the director of a graduate program in the history of the book at University of London, emphasizes this connection inherent in this field in a lecture entitled The Book as Revelation. He says, the history of the book mirrors the history of our understanding of faith or reason, since that understanding is, whether we like it or not, only available from memory as recorded in written language. And indeed, for people who are more cognizant with the particular Jesuit traditions, they might have read the beginning of the autobiography of St. Ignatius of Loyola and recall that that work begins with Father da Camara explaining how he came to write the book. That he listened to Ignatius and then, and this is from the autobiography, I went immediately to write it down, first in notes by my own hand and later at greater length that is now written. And I have striven not to put down any word except those I heard from the Father. But in some things I fear I have failed, because in order not to depart from the Father's word, I have not been able to explain clearly the intent of some of them. And so what I want to talk now about is Madison and then come back to talking about the way in which this field of inquiry fits, I think, very nicely into this university and the concept of Catholic intellectual traditions. Now, I think the problem that da Camara experienced, I think that Ong helps us open up our awareness to, is Madison's central legacy to us. Madison took notes of the Constitutional Convention, and so did eight others, but he was the only one to revise them over his lifetime, and he was the only one to ensure that they would be published in the form that he chose. Of equal importance, and this is lesser known, he was responsible for the fact that the official journal of the convention was finally published in 1820. He was responsible for the critical, and I mean criticized there, reception of all other delegates' notes published during his lifetime. And he was responsible, interestingly, for the delay in Congress adopting a genre of official debates by repeatedly insisting that no official reporter of congressional legislative debates be hired. And in this way, Madison creates the tension between the text of the Constitution and the existence of an imperfect effort to explain or interpret the reason behind that text. So now let me talk specifically about one aspect of this project with legislative notes. And there's some handouts here, and one of the handouts is lots of pictures of Madison, because when you talk about these things, I think it's kind of nice to see what the person looks like. And I am unusual in talking about Madison in that most people for whom Madison looms large look a lot like Madison. And I can say this because my husband is bald. Many of them are bald, and interestingly, Madison was about my height, somewhat unusual in a man, quite short, and everyone can make with that what they want. So there are some images of Madison. And then the other two handouts, one comes from the notes themselves, and then the other, and this is what I'm going to talk about now, are the various revisions to Madison's notes. Okay, Madison's notes are the central document we have of the Constitutional Convention. If people have read Max Baron's text, they're the central version of that text. If people have read any account of what happened at the convention, almost every account of the convention is largely based on Madison's notes. But we often forget how we read the notes. So we tend to approach the notes as if they're a genre we understand. We tend to think that they're something like the congressional record, that they're taken by a stenographer or a reporter. And it's important to realize that at the time Madison takes the notes, there is no genre of congressional records. In England and the colonies, the only official record was a journal. That meant you just took down the minutes, what emotions that happened. And for the public to be present in legislative proceedings was technically a violation. And late into the 19th century, in Parliament, you can clear the entire house by saying, "I spy strangers," and then everybody who's not a member has to leave. This came to an end when an Irish delegate did this, when the Prince of Wales was in the gallery. At that point, they decided that, which was obviously a political statement, they decided that maybe they would get rid of this somewhat by that point, an anachronism. And publishing the proceedings of the House was also a violation of the privilege. And colonial assemblies are largely closed into the 1770s. The Continental Congress is closed. Congress is open, but the Senate is actually closed to the public up until 1795. And so the sort of notion that we have of it was secret, it was all secret. I mean, that was just the way it is. And Congress actually has a set of secret journals that they maintain through the beginning of the 19th century. So there is no genre of taking notes. And in this sense, we have to understand that part of what happens to Madison over his lifetime is he continues to change his notes as his ideas about how you should take notes of something that happened as a legislative matter change. So if we walk, I'm going to walk people quickly through this little set of changes. Madison's notes of the convention are not the notes he actually took at the convention. He destroyed all of those. He destroyed those in the summer of 1787 after he rewrote them. And according to one person who studied this, the notes, even as revised, probably represent at best only 10% of what was said. This was done by a highly scientific study in which Jim Hudson, who writes this, I think somewhat bored at a conference, took notes, then got the transcript, sort of calculated how much could the average person write, and this is using modern technology like a ballpoint pen, not a quill, and he says 10%, other people think probably less. And there's also a technological problem. Madison had to take notes using ink and a quill pen, and if you realize that, that means unlike nowadays when you can write, you have to keep dipping your pen, so you're slowed down that way. And there's also a technology problem in that shorthand in our modern sense hasn't been invented. So shorthand is not done phonetically, it's still alphabetical, which means you're just incredibly limited in how much you can take down of what somebody says. So whatever his notes look like, they don't exist any longer. And what he does instead is, in the summer of 1787, while he's still at the convention, he begins to rewrite his notes. And his original notes in the format, and these are his original notes, if you sort of read back through them, they were in what one might think of as a diary form. And this does not mean a private diary, but they were a public diary. This is how he had taken notes before. He wrote them on very expensive, nice paper, so he clearly intended to keep them. And he wrote himself into the notes, which if you just think about if I were trying to take notes on myself, I would obviously have the worst notes on myself, I would have the best notes on everybody else. And so the most dubious part in terms of representing what was actually said is, of course, Madison on Madison. Now, we forget this, and so we cite Madison on Madison at the convention. But those are the parts of the notes that we should be most suspicious about. Then, very soon after, in 1789, he goes through and he makes a major revision. We can call this revision 2 in the text. And he does this while he's trying to draft the Bill of Rights. And in this, he gets the official journal of the convention. He makes a copy that he wasn't supposed to make, possibly with Washington's permission, possibly not with Washington's permission. And he begins to interlace more official proceedings back in to his own notes. So he makes his notes look more official. And he also begins to try not to hurt anyone's feelings. And that is a part of Madison's character that we should be very cautious about. So, for example, in his original notes, he said that Washington lamented his want of the requisites for the job of being head of the convention. And that sounds like Washington wasn't very, you know, was really lacking. And Madison changed it to his want of better qualifications, you know, which is a little bit more flattering. Similarly, he had a quite critical, sarcastic comment about the fact that Franklin hadn't shown up because of the rain, and he changed it to the state of the weather and his health confined him to his house, which was a much more diplomatic way of saying that Franklin couldn't walk two blocks down from his house to bother to show up. And you would think historians have tended to take this first revision as unproblematic, but they're incredibly problematic. When Madison wrote Randolph, at this point, could I have your notes? Because I cannot do justice of the substance of your speech from my own notes. Randolph writes back, I'm sending you what I have, but I am not, quote, dilating them. And this is what he says. Because I fear I should mingle inadvertently much of what I have heard since without being able to separate from what occurred then. So Randolph, in 2 years, already understands that the entire nature of American politics and language has changed so profoundly that he doesn't think he can go back. Madison has less qualms about this and goes back. So he does that. Then, and now don't worry, I'm not going to spend so much time here. There's a third revision. Jefferson comes back. Jefferson's been hanging out in Paris. So Madison and Washington are best buddies. Jefferson comes back. In some ways destroying the Washington-Madison relationship as he sort of seduces Madison towards his side. And Jefferson's obsessed with preservation. He's learned about the letterpress, and he persuades Madison to make a copy of the notes. And this is done by this poor young guy who's supposed to be learning the law from Jefferson, but instead has to laboriously copy this. And then Jefferson, maybe with Madison's permission, uses the technology available to make another copy. And so he does this. And what's interesting is there's a section of the notes that Madison doesn't allow to be copied. It's a section of the notes that contain six examples, basically, of pages in which Madison changed the paper. And they're all speeches that Madison gives. They all contain parts that Madison gives. And this part is never copied. So we have no, Madison never gives anybody sort of a text from which you could say, well, this is what you originally said, and this is what you didn't say. So Jefferson copies three-fourths of the debate, and this is what I call revision three, because in essence, Madison's holding back some section, whether he revises it after or whether he thought his revisions were so obvious at that point he didn't want someone to see them. Then he and Jefferson become best buds and decide that politics needs to go in an opposite direction. They're in antagonism with George Washington. Washington shows up in a debate over a treaty and says, I'm right, and if you don't believe me, here's the official journal of the convention, and plops it down on the table. He was the only one. And Madison writes Jefferson Jefferson's not there. Quick, basically, doesn't say quick. Look at my notes and see what are said. But then the mail has to go to Virginia and back. And so the next day, in the meantime, he walks in and he says, what the founder said shouldn't say anything. This is actually a speech that gets quoted all the time out of context. It's in this moment. He doesn't have his notes. His notes are there. Jefferson's the only one with notes. I mean, Washington's the only one with notes. And Madison now realizes that the notes are part of a political conversation. And he goes back and replaces about 5 more pages with another kind of paper during these years. These are all pages in which he and Washington and Jefferson don't see eye to eye. They involve changes in how issues involving treaties come into the Constitution. Okay, then Madison serves as president, he mellows, he looks back on this period as I was too imbued with the party spirit during those years, and he and Jefferson now become convinced that nobody understands the convention. This is beginning with Madison's retirement, and Madison begins to make a 5th revision of his work, this time with his brother-in-law. He was always getting other people to do a lot of the handwriting by this point. And he begins to try and explain things. So he starts adding a set of footnotes to the notes. But he also becomes increasingly aware of how dangerous his notes are. And this is the period when American politics is becoming roiled with slavery. And Madison's original notes talk extensively about a debate between people who wanted to abolish slavery and people, particularly in South Carolina and Georgia, who said, we'll split if slavery isn't protected in the Constitution. And Madison begins increasingly to say, maybe my notes shouldn't be published during my lifetime. And he increasingly says to people, I'm scared my notes will be used to improper use. And it seems largely to be slavery. Madison at this point is no longer anti-slavery in the way that we sometimes misunderstand him. He thinks slavery should be gone, but he's a big believer that everybody who is African or African American should be recolonized back to Africa. Then in his will, what's so interesting is he comes back, now travels full circle, and he comes back to seeing his notes as a report. He says, a report as made by me. He comes back at the end of the life to emphasizing his notes as a personal narrative. As just one person's voice on what had happened, and he insists that his notes get published with other documents and other letters as part of a conversation. And Dolly Madison actually fulfills this. She refuses to give the notes by themselves to a publisher, even though people keep trying to tell her that this will be the most lucrative manner. So he sort of returns to the notion that notes aren't official, that they're to be understood in context. But after his day, here we have revision 7, the notes, this part of Madison's papers get pulled out of context and increasingly read, particularly in debates over slavery, as an official text, as something that we can begin to understand as the genre of debates. And nowadays, what's so interesting is I think we have an 8th revision to his notes, which is his notes are easily accessible on online versions. And what's so interesting about these online versions is because of the way hypertext works, the minute you click through, you forget, right, that this is Madison. It looks like an official text just like everything else. And I think in large part, these online editions have gone to support the kind of original meaning jurisprudence that we see often today in the Supreme Court. So now let me come back to where I started. I think the first important conclusion to be drawn from this is that Madison and his generation did not destroy materials that would provide a fuller account of the Constitution. But they didn't dictate what the relationship of the Constitution to this material was or should be. In fact, I think they didn't really know. And perhaps we've been too much like DeCamera, the person who took down Ignatius' notes, in thinking that we fail because we can't get the literal words to disclose intent. I think too often we wanted this text to be binary, either official so that we can draw a conclusion about Framer's intent, or irrelevant so that we can become textualists and look only at the Constitution. But Madison's own effort to write his memory was filled with tension and unresolved ambiguities, and as I note, he traveled a circular path, struggling with the potential usefulness of this text and its inherent danger, and I actually think we should be more willing to revel in it. Now, how does this project connect to the Catholic intellectual traditions? Does it belong as much at the center of academic endeavors here as much as topics that lead perhaps more easily to mind? Everyone obviously has their own answer. For myself, I would like to believe that questions about the nature of politics, about the way in which writing structures memory and consciousness, and about the relationship of memory and text to power will always have an important place at this university. So thank you, and thank you for indulging a slightly longer version.